how cool is it basically? I mean, I'm a big The Weeknd fan. I mean, and I
yeah.
know a piece of acquaintance. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
also from an intrinsic consumer perspective, I mean, how freaking cool is that? Huh?
It's great.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on. It is a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
No, thank you. So background is basically we got connected with you because you were a part of some of the funding rounds for another block, which is really cool, which we'll dive into further. But one of the things I noticed, which we spoke about last time, is sort of the contrast between the Nordic tech scene and that which people talk about in sort of the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, stuff like that. And I think that's heightened by something I looked at the other day. So on Netflix here in Australia, this new series has come out, which shows the whole backstory of Spotify. I've only watched one episode, but it's really interesting. And it's got the guy, I think it's Daniel Ek. Is that how you say his name? Yep.
Yes.
And like he's kind of like the genius behind it. And that inspired me. I was like, this is like such a good example of probably what you're going to talk about. But maybe could you give us a bit of some background, what you've experienced in the Nordic tech scene versus Silicon Valley?
Of course. I mean, Jeremy, I actually need to start watching the series though.
Yeah.
Me and my girlfriend started it on the weekend, but then we stopped watching it halfway through, and I have heard mixed feedback. So I think I need to make a picture myself. But I think to answer this question properly, I think we need to kind of like compare the status quo now with there's like where the Nordic tech scene have been in the early 2000s and a bit earlier, because I think the Nordics were always an early adopters of technology. I mean, looking at, for example, Nokia and Ericsson, basically two incumbent players who basically drove the tech scene and the technology development up in the Nordics. And I think then expanded over the globe, right? And I think generally that the Nordics have been always very early adopter of any kinds of technology, right? And I think this also then drove kind of like the foundation of which Spotify and Klarna, for example, built on. I mean, the bandwidth, the broadcast, the internet generally was in a better shape than compared to the rest of Europe. And I think also across lion's share of the market in the US, right? And I think this was then also supported by another layer, which is kind of like the welfare support, which is kind of like extraordinary compared to, let's say, Central European markets, that the all the governments basically supporting early stage technology companies quite heavily with public funding, right? And I think this kind of like very special compared to, let's say, I mean, I'm a German, right? And in Germany, we don't have this to this extent that you can basically apply for governmental funding if you're an early tech company. And this obviously lifts up all the ecosystem as well, right? And I think then what we have seen then in the next step is kind of like there's a strong community feeling in the Nordics and also in the Baltics in a sense that kind of like you see the recycling and the churn of talent basically by basically coming or like, let's say, operators turn entrepreneurs, right? And this is also kind of like very special that you see the early employees from Spotify, Klarna, Zettle, you name them, kind of like spinning out of the companies, building something themselves, and then kind of like getting re-engaged in the ecosystem, and then the money flow is getting in, captured in the ecosystem itself, right? And I think it's like we have tons of examples. And I mean, for example, one of the former Skype founders has obviously founded Atomico, which is obviously one of the largest UK funds we have around here, right? So you see the kind of like strong community building process here that kind of like all the kind of like founders and operators from the ecosystem are getting re-engaged and money sticks in the environment. And I think this also like has a lot to do with kind of like we're a smaller ecosystem, but with stronger people. And then based on that, we have seen the kind of like rise from the Nordic tech scene, right? And I think also one factor which shouldn't be neglected is obviously the wide range of talent we get out of the Nordics. I mean, we have strong engineering universities, right? And I think that's also obviously driven by what the tech scene basically is, right? And I think this is, I think, my biggest success factors for the Nordics compared to the Silicon Valley, I would say.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's really good, because I never really thought about it, like how the government is supporting the growth as opposed to how private venture capital actually supports the growth. So that's a really interesting distinction. You used to work as an analyst at the Macquarie Group in healthcare mergers and acquisitions. So that's obviously a pretty large competitor to where I'm at now. So it was like a fairly recent transition. Obviously, wanting to know kind of what are the shared skills and shared kind of areas, and how did you go from going from Macquarie to venture capital?
Yeah, I mean, you guys are Australians, right? And I think Macquarie is, funny enough, I think a big thing in Australia.
Huge.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first days I started at McCrory as an intern back in the days, one of our MDs, like, I remember, like, came with a magazine or, like, a news article, was like, hey, look, guys, McCrory was called Millionaire's Factory or something in Sydney, yeah. I guess, was it? Yeah. I mean, trust me, I never saw that on my bank account. but... far, far away from that. But I think, like, take a step back from here, why I went from McCrory, right? I think it's, like, obviously was a consciously decision to go the hard road to investment banking. And I think I have a major in finance. I studied back in the days in Lisbon, and already in my bachelor, kind of, like, I did tons of internship, M&A, private equity. And then it's kind of like I ended up in this type of bubble where everybody is kind of like priming you. Okay, you study finance, you're studying management, you need to go to consultancy, private equity, banking. So obviously I ended up there myself. And funny enough, like one of my last internships, I was at McCrory, and I actually found amazing friends with whom I then also started there and went to McCrory basically. And I mean, I started more or less as a generalist in a sense, as we all are, because we don't have this kind of like sector, or we didn't have the sector teams like in UK, for example, or like it is in Australia, right? And then kind of like I was gotten more in touch with like a lot of healthcare transactions. So basically, this was basically my, let's say, expertise area, which also excel out now at InVenture. But what I basically learned at McCrory, and I think I wouldn't miss out on this opportunity. And if I would redo my career, I would probably do it again, because it sounds funny, but like I think it filled my toolbox quite heavily with tons of skills. Like, is it reliability? Is it kind of like attention to detail? Is it obviously financial modeling skills and kind of like the general financial sense, or kind of like getting inside of kind of like how blue chips company operate, and kind of like how incumbent player are really structured from inside out perspective? And then also obviously on the other side, like all the soft skills, right? I mean, you need to work under pressure, you need to work fast, you need to work accuracy, you need to be reliable. I mean, obviously sleep was a rare commodity, right? I mean, it's like something I almost didn't get, but I think I learned from it, right? And I think it somehow fills your toolbox, which I wouldn't miss. And I think it helps me now with my job at InVenture quite heavily, right? Because I think a lot of those attributes are now kind of like by default, right? So I have no problem kind of like working hard and long, because it's like I was used to something else. But I think what I most learned is kind of like where my kind of like passion lies, because I work with so many incumbent players and like large blue chips, stock listed companies in the DAX or MDAX, for example. And what I learned there is kind of like that there's so much need for digitization and technology for those big companies. And there's kind of like no willingness to adapt basically, right? And then we had this principal finance arm, and kind of one of our former MDs was basically then carving out himself to Gorillas as a CFO. So like in Germany and in Europe, this quick commerce company trying to deliver in 50 minutes for everybody who doesn't know it. And he was always looking at kind of like tech heavy companies, because we had this kind of like venture arm covering Series A to C there. And they kind of got the hunch of like how fascinating this basically is, and how close you basically work with the founders themselves and really can have an impact, right? And then I figured out, okay, I don't want to work anymore with kind of like very well-run companies with kind of like lack of digitization, technology orientation. And I mean, I saw it myself, right? I mean, implementation of a new CRM takes, 2 years in those companies, right? And then I decided, also driven because my girlfriend is Finnish, and then I kind of like put my bags together and moved to Finland, and obviously did some research and kind of talked to tons of people in the German ecosystem in the venture space, kind of like what is the seed early stage funds I should talk to. And then basically everyone pointed me towards InVenture. And how I ended up there was kind of a funny story, because I was like actually screening the team, and then I was like, okay, they don't have any career page whatsoever, and I really want to work there, because I think they had done plenty of investments, healthcare, fintech, everything where I can see myself as well. And then I was basically finger pointing out, okay, who is looking most polite and nice of the team? Everybody is amazing, obviously, you know? So everybody who listened to that, I love you all. But like, then I ended up sending Sami, one of our founding partners, a cold email. And then actually, for some reason, he was ambitious enough to answer a German douchebag, sending him a cold email. And then I basically ended up and kind of like found my passion, I would say.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. It's good inspiration for anyone who's listening, like just to put yourself out there, because you never, like, until you try, you don't know. And so that's pretty cool.
That's a good saying from my grandma. She always taught me, like, you already have the no, just work on the yes, right? So I think it's
true
in your life.
True. Wise grandma. I like that. That's cool. It's interesting
very
to
wise
hear.
Grandma, I can tell you.
It's that was true, and it's obviously passed on to you. You're a wise man, and it's interesting to hear you talk about the contrast between sort of some of that late stage financing stuff that you're doing with Macquarie. And then making more of an impact in the early stage round and having more ability to craft and mold what's happening. And that's probably more satisfaction in that, I can imagine, which is kind of what you were saying. So I was just thinking, so you've got all this background in finance, you studied it, you worked at Macquarie Bank. And the other thing which we should definitely touch on, which I think brings a lot of context to your story, is your little startup that you did, which was Novus Active. And it was a new type of pillow. Is that right?
Yeah, so basically
I don't know, maybe that was a bad characterization of it. You tell us what it was.
Yes, so basically how it started, like we were studying Lisbon, I had a good friend of mine, and kind of like we always were trying to optimize everything in our lives, like, and then we ended up at sleep, and in Lisbon you're like, you always had this super thin and big pillows, like I couldn't sleep on them whatsoever, and like always complained a bit of my neck. And then we were kind of like looking, okay, we want to do anyway something together, or like starting something and kind of figuring out if entrepreneur wrote something for us or not. And then kind of like we did a lot of research, and then kind of like this ergonomic pillows, right? Those kind of like S form shaped pillows, which basically straighten your spine and then kind of like, first of all, promotes the circulation of the blood in, close to your head, and like this shifts over kind of like a lot of vital parameters why you sleep better, right? And then we first, to be honest, didn't think about kind of like doing a wee business out of it. So we first started kind of like, okay, we can do this classic Alibaba arbitrage,
yeah,
like sourcing cheap,
yep,
selling expenses of Amazon using Amazon FBA.
Amazing.
But then we kind of like had a hard time to find a real good supplier and then a good fulfillment provider. And then we got in touch with a German startup called Hive, right? It's like, I think as of now, a Series A startup raised $35 million from Tiger Global back in the days. And those guys told us like, why are you guys not doing a real business out of it, right? And we're doing the fulfillment for you, and then kind of you the marketing, etc. And then yeah, we basically started off like, instead of like sourcing from China, we found a factory in Italy, kind of with our products there,
wow,
and then kind of like sort of through our platform.
Amazing.
And I think I've learned quite a lot in this journey.
Yeah.
Not only that I was a terrible founder myself, and that kind of like it also kind of like if you do it with a close friend of yours, it's kind of like also, you need to be very resistant in your kind of friendship, because I think it kind of like we face a lot of difficult situations there. And I think,
are you still friends?
Kind of yeah, we're still
friends. Okay,
nice. No, but I learned a lot from this journey, and I think a lot kind of I can see also now, and kind of like when I see founders and especially friends who trying to find a company, and I think I can kind of understand a lot of mechanisms they have and they face in very, very early context. But I think I also kind of, I think it taught me more about myself than it can basically apply right now on my validation on founder teams. I do know what I'm looking for at founder teams, but the kind of like, it probably brought more to myself, my persona, than I can leverage now for my day-to-day job.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's that's a really cool insight into the kind of the relationship between the founder and yourself, and how you've actually had a go at trying to create something, which is really cool, because I think a lot of the people kind of haven't really tried to do something, and then they don't have that fundamental like understanding of the stress that the founder's under to actually make it happen. So in the world of VC, it's all about building a portfolio of growing companies, right? And basically Nathan and I have talked
in the best case scenario, yes.
Yeah, in the best case,
ideally,
yeah. Some of them obviously crash and burn, but you try and minimize that. So Nathan and I talked to a VC in here in Australia a couple of months ago, and basically we asked him about some of the key measures to kind of measure success. And so the first one that he kind of brought up was revenue growth as a percentage. So he was, you know, he was looking for 300% to 400% if he was looking for something really early, and if he was looking at a later stage kind of thing, he was kind of looking at 100% growth. He also was looking at net revenue retention, which is basically, do the customers get more business, do they pay more for business over time. So to break it down, it's basically it's net revenue retention, so it's monthly recurring revenue plus new expansion to that monthly recurring revenue over time, and then take away that monthly churn that you're getting. And so basically it's, yeah, it's also a great measure of growth. So basically, do you have any kind of key rules or metrics that you're kind of looking at as the first point of call when you're taking on a new business?
So I think, I mean, we are a very early stage investor, right? I mean, we're usually investing in pre-seed and seed. And I would presume the investor you talk to is like majority into B2B SaaS, probably, right? Because I think those metrics just described fitting quite heavily on B2B SaaS. And I think considering that we are a very agnostic fund, we're looking at pretty much everything tech enabled. And I think first of all, being early and being kind of like very agnostic, I think it's hard to put kind of like the metrics into numbers. I mean, of course, we have industry specific metrics, right? I think if it's a marketplace, we're looking at GMV and the take rate, for example, and then kind of like obviously the consumer business, CAC LTV is very, very important for us. But I think generally, as a rule of thumb, I would say, when we look at pre-seed companies, there's no metrics to track, right? I think what we do basically is doing a bet on the entrepreneur or founding team, depends how many people are there, and then on the pure market opportunity, right? Because I think we VCs, we like market opportunities and large markets, because we still in the game of the power of power of distribution, basically, right? We need this outline in our portfolio, and that's why we need to always look at the market size, right? And then if you look at the seed stage, we obviously want to have a validation of the first MVP, preferably in place, and at least some traction in the initial home market or local market, right? And then we also want to kind of like see, let's say, early indicators of product market fits, depends on what kind of product we're looking at in service, and then kind of like the capability of the founders to attract the right talent, right? I think those are parameters you can easily track and seed. And then when it comes to Series A and beyond, then metrics are kicking in and becoming more important, right? And I think obviously I can't speak for all the funds out there, and I think they also need to kind of like have their own measures in a particular stage. But I think once you get to the Series A stage, you need to deliver on growth on revenue side. You need to expand to a second, third, and fourth country. You need to have a stellar team around you, basically have product market fit, created your defensibility and uniqueness, basically, or like how you always call it, like the moat. And then basically deliver on the specific industry metrics, right? And I think every founder can leverage tons of podcasts and tons of reports from the large US funds out there, which are tracking basically what is the current like standard or let's say merit of metrics tracking out there, right? And I think especially for SaaS, there's tons of data out there. But I think coming back to our stage pre-seed and seed, it's kind of like we obviously look at certain parameters in the specific verticals, but I think it's hard to put it on a real number.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, so you're saying there basically that InVenture is happy to invest in sort of any industry if they see it being profitable. Okay, so they're not necessarily focused on one thing, which is cool.
We are like 16, 17 years old, right? And I think we have invested in a broad range. I think we are like one of the only investors in the Nordics, like basically covering everything from, let's say, really deep tech, IoT, semiconductors, to kind of basically Web3 nowadays, right? And I think we have certain things which we are not good at, and then we don't cover it. For example, like certain parameters in Web3, but I think I can elaborate later on it as well. But I think there's almost nothing we shy away, even hardware we do, right? And I think even hardware-related cases are one of the almost successful ones, which is most recently Swappy, right? And I think it's kind of like unique in our positioning, I would say.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay. So in regards to how a VC fund works, so if you guys have a bunch of LPs who have provided a bunch of cash that you guys can invest, right? And you're one of the GPs and you've got the opportunity to manage that and sort of make some decisions as to where that funding can go. And I guess some assumptions on my behalf is there's some reporting that you're probably going to have to do, let them know how everything's tracking, where they're at. I guess my question is, and this is a genuine question, if I, as an LP, someone who's investing a bunch of money into InVenture, do I get any say in where that money's going? And I'm just thinking, I guess what I'm trying to hit here is there's a lot of people who are like sort of incumbent in the financial industry who hear the term crypto or Web3 and it really scares them. And so, and I mean, less and less nowadays, but there are still people like that. And so I guess what I'm trying to flesh out is, are there LPs who are scared by an investment in a company like another block because it seems like this concept that doesn't make sense in their head? Or are they even really not even aware that InVenture is sort of all of the individual investments that you're making?
So I think I need to be, I mean, obviously can't reveal everything here. So we need to be quite cryptic, right? But so generally speaking, I think smaller LPs surely don't have a particular say in a sense, right? And I think that's quite common. But I think like when it comes to larger LPs who kind of have a lion's share of, let's say, the fund size, basically, right? And I think especially European or globally financial authorities like companies and LPs in this sense, they surely have obviously kind of like certain requirements what they want to see on the investment on kind of like certain funds where they allocate their money to, right? And I think this can come in every shape and form, right? I mean, some asking you kind of like definitely taking in some share of like your geographic coverage, or like some asking you taking in a share of, like, for example, very kind of like climate or green tech driven,
because
it's currently kind of like a very important topic, right? And I think especially when it comes then to the global kind of like industry, and when we look at the global industries, right, I think there are always going to be the big financial authorities which are investing you as an LP in your fund, who kind of require a certain allocation to this type of very kind of like driven topics, right? And also when it comes, especially for Web3, they're like, I think, especially in Europe, a lot of funds which basically can't invest in tokens, right? Because the current LP agreement doesn't allow it, right? And I think it makes totally sense to me, because I believe like token is not kind of like something very common when you're a VC investor, right? So you usually should structure it on a legal perspective differently to be allowed to invest in tokens, because I think it also like a different impact on the taxation side of things and also on the risk exposure, right? And I think if you look kind of like at the big ones like Paradigm, A16Z, et cetera, like when they have invested in the tokens, and then basically I've a couple of weeks ago checked basically the performance of the tokens, and I mean I would have hard time to justify the large drop and sunk in valuation and then TBPI in a perspective, right? And I think that's why I'm also a fan that those requirements are existing, right? Because I think at the end of the day we have a very, very strong responsibility of investing this money in our best interest, right? Because it's not always high net worth individuals investing in the funds, or like, let's say, family offices, right? It's also pension funds, insurance companies. And I think this money we invest is in the best possible way then kind of like multiplied by X, right? And so that kind of like also the people which pension is depending on it, or like which insurance is depending on it, get money back and not having a gap which needs to be covered, right? And then we're talking about a totally different impact on the long term, right? So I think we always, as a fund and as a GPs, we have the best responsibility to invest in kind of like where we believe it has the biggest uptick, and not kind of like just where we just feel it's good. So that's why I'm also a fan that certain requirements are in place, basically.
Amazing.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that because you don't often think about all of the investor types in a venture capital. You often think, oh yeah, it's just crazy founders going really hard and trying to get massive growth. But yeah, you obviously don't think about the pension funds and all of that are kind of also involved as LPs. So I've gone and had a look at a few of the funds, a few of the investments that you've been involved in. And sometimes you observe, and sometimes you sit on the board of these companies. And so there's Anyday, which looks like a buy now pay later. There's Bunch, which is a leadership coach. There's Madoma, which is a health dashboard for monitoring people that are remotely. That can be remotely monitored.
It's not a dashboard per se. It's even better than a dashboard. So I think I think it's a very, very interesting one, because when you look about kind of like what we've seen in COVID, and kind of like just giving a short 15-second introduction here, is that you have the overcapacity in hospitals, that kind of like a lot of acute patients basically need to be declined on the door because there's simply not enough space in the hospital or enough staff, right? So what they're basically doing is like taking the acute cases home and treating them at home. So basically, if you break your leg, Nathan or Isaac, and then basically you get declined by the door, or you can also decide to be treated by Madoma, basically, right? So then you get home, and then a nurse comes, a doctor comes, and treats you with everything what you need at home, basically.
Yeah. It is a very it's a very clever idea. That one, it's very useful for, you know, especially in the current environment when people have to be remote with COVID and everything.
Totally.
And there's also obviously you also sit on the Another Block board. So I wanted to know what it's like kind of managing all of these portfolio companies. Are you given your own specific portfolio of companies that you have to specifically look after? And like, is it your responsibility to show up and help with those decisions? Or are you just kind of, you sit on a few different ones and take over from other people and it's mixed around more?
So I think there's a lot of different dimension to this question. So I think generally, it's like always good questions with I could answer probably 10 minutes on.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So for generally speaking, it's like I think the decision who's going to work with the company is having two dimensions, right? I think on the one hand side, who's involved in the deal making process and basically who's the closest to the founders. But obviously, this is only one part, because we, at least as a venture, are always trying to assemble the teams working with the companies based on the expertise, right? And that's obviously one dimension. So, and all of the investments I'm sitting on the board or as an observer, I've done myself or was myself involved. But on the other hand side, obviously, there's also like a lot of deals I might be involved in, but I don't have any expertise in, right? So I think then we're looking more like who in our team has the best expertise to help the company, right? Because our interest is always to elevate the company in the best interest and not kind of like becoming this type of structure where it's only kind of like a deal driven and kind of like deal maker driven approach, right? So because when we sit on the board, we have also a huge responsibility towards the companies, right? And I think there's kind of like this famous quote from Reid Hoffman, and I hope I can get it right. And I think he said something like, a bad board member can break the company faster than a good board member can make the company, right? And I think there's a lot of truth in it, because we always need to have the right motivation, right? And as a board member, you're there, for example, to understand the company, to understand the market, to challenge the founders, advise the founders, and also encourage them in a certain aspect. And we are not basically there to implement or execute, right? So, and that's kind of like also very important to understand. And I think also another dimension is that you as a board member, you need to be ready to make tough decisions, right? And I think you shouldn't shy away of taking up a step and also telling the truth when it's like very rough time, right? And I think it's not the easiest, but it sometimes needs to be done, right? And I think it's just essential to have a healthy boardroom. And I think this also contributes then to the initial question, basically, like selecting who is sitting on the board or helping the company, right? Because I think we always need to structure it in the best interest and kind of like who is hitting those parameters and can help the company basically going forward, right? And a bit to the time allocation, I think it's a very good question. I think you always have certain times when you're less involved or more involved with a portfolio company, right? So it can be that, I don't know, you don't really work one or two quarters with the company because the company is running smoothly, and every now and then you have a board meeting and they have some questions and everything goes well. But then on the other side, then if you prepare for fundraising or if you prepare, let's say, for a market expansion or something, then you have obviously more recurring board meetings, and then you're maybe a bit more heavily involved. Or when it's also not going well, then obviously you're also a bit more involved, right? But hopefully that shouldn't be too often the case. But I think that's kind of like how at least I structure it, kind of like looking who of the portfolio companies need right now the most help, and then structure my day-to-day accordingly, and also trying to figure out in which shape and form I can help. Because I think we as Inventure, we have also like an operator team by our side focusing on talent expansion, like basically everything around talent acquisition, talent structuring, go-to-market, sales strategy, etc., where we have hired basically experts, right? And I'm not the expert in those fields. So that's why I'm also always happy to kind of like lift off our talent expansion team here. And I think that's kind of like a big value add we have as well.
Yeah, gotcha. That's really cool. And yeah, those value adds are often what a lot of VCs will talk about, in addition to just the funding. And so it's good. And it's I'm glad you touched on some of that stuff as well. So if we look at another block, for example, maybe that's why some people have come to listen to this. As an example of one of the companies that you look after within the portfolio, that is Inventure. So context, as far as I'm aware, is J12 Ventures did like maybe like pre-seed is what you would call
yeah.
it.
Yeah, that's correct.
For another block. And then you guys came in with a bunch of other organizations or entities and did a seed round. Is that what it would be called?
Yep. That's totally correct. I think it was in April or May.
So you led that, and which was cool. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about maybe what was interesting about another block, what made them investable, and just stuff like that, just as one example of one company that you looked at?
I mean, totally. And I think I can also bring a bit of the Web3 component in here,
great.
Because I think it's also like one of a lot of people are probably interested in. So I remember like the first call I had with Michelle back in the day, right? And I think we bonded quite heavily after the first couple of minutes, right? Because we had the same interest, like we listened to the same music, and kind of like he's a very visionary type of guy. And that's kind of like also what I envy about a lot of founders, kind of like having the creative strings and finding the dots between certain connections where others don't see the connection, right? And I could see this in Michelle from the get-go. That's why kind of like after the first call, I was quite intrigued, right? And I think considering that it's something was something so new, and also for Inventure, I think it's fair to say that Another Block was our first ever Web3 investment. And maybe taking a step by the side and kind of elaborate why that is and kind of like a bit on our thesis so that it gets basically clear why. Because, I mean, we are not a Web3 investor, right? I think we will never be a dedicated Web3 investor because you need to understand basically everything from protocol layer to basically access layer, right? And we don't have the technical expertise to basically judge on developer tools or, let's say, the engineering side on the blockchain, right? So that we can really deep dive into the code of L1, L2, scaling, bridges, et cetera, right? And that's also not our ambition, basically, right? Because as a Web2 fund, even I hate this word. Like, it's so stupid, right? No, but we need to kind of think also about like where are we good at and what can we understand, right? So what we basically did then when we drafted our Web3 thesis was like, okay, we understand kind of like use cases in Web2 and which can definitely work on Web3 and give another kind of like technical component on top and kind of enabling even something which was not there before, right? And then obviously kind of like everything consumer related, we understand perfectly, right? So we can also basically look at kind of like consumer cases. But in this particular thing, as you guys know, like, I mean, when it comes to consumer on Web3, it's always Discord first, right? Go to market is always Discord first, right? So it's also kind of like, where do we see, like, let's say the longevity to basically build a real platform out of it on top of it with kind of like also getting users, let's say, Web 2.5 and Web 2 users into the product or application or platform, whatever, right? And then I think even more crucial, and I think that's also something we understand quite well, is kind of like how you basically trigger the access and make this kind of like mainstream. Because I think we still have a huge problem of onboarding people to Web 3. Because, I mean, opening up a MetaMask, getting ETH MetaMask takes 20 minutes, and try this to explain to my mom or my grandma, doesn't work, right? So obviously we need to fix first this main problem of like kind of like making blockchain Web3 mass adaptable in terms of like on-ramping, off-ramping. So we understand this as well. So I think this was kind of like our two, let's say, layers in kind of like this Web3 stack. If I have this kind of like in front of my eyes right now, the access layer and the kind of like use case layer is something where we see ourselves, right? And then when I looked at Another Block, it's kind of like, okay, well, music was there forever. We apply new technology by basically wrapping the royalties into NFTs and basically enabling, first of all, the community to take a part of it. And on the other hand side, basically giving ownership back also to kind of like the creators on the long tail, right? Because there's kind of, when we look at kind of like the royalty distribution, I mean, the large chunk goes to the big four, like Warner, Universal, etc. And kind of like the first time I looked at it, I was almost selling off my share. I was like, Jesus Christ, like, how can they take like 67% of the royalties? Like, I mean, they're not Beyoncé or Jay-Z. Like, they're just sitting there and signing contracts, right?
Yeah.
So this was kind of like something which kind of like puzzled me a lot. And it's kind of like then deep dived into it. And I mean, from private equity side, I knew that kind of like royalty catalogs is a thing, basically, right? By kind of like purchasing them, it's because it was an illiquid asset. So this was kind of like probably the first link I had in terms of like, okay, well, we can make an illiquid asset basically liquid, right? By offering an exchange, an underlying exchange to basically IPO, in a sense, those royalties. And basically, first of all, getting a share of revenues directly to the artists or producers, whoever is basically selling those royalties, but also enabling the community to take a part of it, right? And I think by decentralizing the ownership of music and giving power back to the artists and basically the creators, I think this was something where we felt quite strong with, because it's basically a new category the guys are creating here and has nothing been done before. So obviously it's kind of very bold to take this kind of like very ambitious bet as our first Web3 investment, what we believed in it, right? Because both all of them, Philip, Sebastian and Michelle, all had kind of like this drive and the motivation to really create something here, right? And which might sound kind of like very visionary for us in the very first instance when we invested after almost, let's say, 6 months, we are far ahead of what we have discussed back in the days, and we can clearly see the progress the guys are doing. And I mean, I'm just kudos to the guy, they're doing a phenomenal job here, right? And I think they're thinking already in terms of like where they want to be in 3, 4, 5 years, and it's not going to be kind of like this, let's say, marketplace for NFTs anymore. And that's also what was very important for us. How do we get from the first use case to let the platform play, right? And I think it's always nice to sell out nice NFTs, right? But we all knew that it's not kind of like a long-lasting product, basically. And I mean, I won't say too much because I think it's kind of like lies in their hand where they're going to go in 2 or 3 years. But I think the future is very, very, very promising for those guys. And that's where basically we then made the decision on kind of like pursuing this investment, because even though we may not understood the technology in the first layer and could kind of judge the code, but we believed in the story, and we considered that we are very strong in marketplaces from our previous investments. Laurie and I decided then eventually to do it.
Amazing.
I couldn't have said it better there with in terms of creating a secondary market for music, because that's kind of the way that I originally got excited about it as an idea, because it's a secondary market for music, which actually creates like an entirely new like asset class, right? It's like, you know, it's completely different from your stocks and your other stuff, because it's like you're investing in music, which is really cool.
Exactly. And I mean, how cool is it basically? I mean, I'm a big The Weeknd fan, I mean, and I only know a piece of acquaintance. Like, yeah, I mean, yeah. Also from an intrinsic consumer perspective, I mean, how freaking cool is that? Huh?
It's great.
yeah, absolutely. So basically, one thing that is kind of sort of your area of expertise, at least on InVentures' website, is exits. So one of the ways that exits kind of happen is like acquisitions or sales to larger companies or to fund managers, private equity, and we also see more of the Silicon Valley way is the publicly list for $1 billion, you know, and so basically we have also there's like some other methods, like, you know, secondary trading of private shares and stuff like that amongst some owners and whatever. What's the best type of exit that you like to deal with, and what does InVenture generally try and aim for?
Big ones. Just really big ones.
Yeah.
Always $1 billion exits, right?
Yeah.
No, I think it's a tricky question. I think first of all, I don't know who put it on the website. I mean, obviously, I have an M&A and IPO expertise, but haven't yet done an exit with an InVenture.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very tricky question, right? I think we need to differentiate between, I think, how you want to even differentiate here. Because I think some businesses, especially when it's kind of like very on a deep tech end, for example, what you see basically is that a lot of funding rounds at one point, some of the strategic players trying to kind of capture already some of the shares throughout the funding rounds, so you can basically understand that this will become a trade sale at one point. Because I think the characteristics of an IPO, they need to be perfect to make a successful IPO, and kind of everyone who has worked on an IPO, like let's say dual track between M&A and IPO, understands like how tricky an IPO basically is and successful IPO basically is, right? Because it comes with a lot of challenges, because it's not only kind of like the company which needs to perform amazingly, but it's also the macro environment. I mean, we see it right now in the market, the IPO market is basically dead, right? I think in Germany there was only one large IPO, which was Porsche, and I think other than that I can't remember. Yeah, exactly. I can't remember one single IPO above 250 million euros this year in Germany alone, right? And I think that this dependency on an IPO or on the macro environment and general market conditions is making IPO for me, in a wide extent, probably very unsexy per se, right? But I think some exits just need to go through an IPO, because I mean, who should buy a Klarna? Who should buy a Spotify, right? I think there are no perfect suitors in terms of M&A, or let's say I'm on the private equity side of things. So I think for the big tech players, an IPO is the only successful route here, right? And for let's say the companies who are not going to be the decacorns of the world, I think most of the time M&A or private equity acquisition is the most attractive exit route here, right? But I think I'm not going to put my hand in the fire here and say that there's a certain parameters to judging what is a good M&A case, what is a good IPO case. But I would say like everything above, let's say 10, 15 billion valuation, I think it's a strong and attractive IPO case, right? And I think those acquisitions like Figma or let's say Slack, they don't happen every year, right? I think those are quite extraordinary here. So usually all the founders prefer to be an IPO route.
Gotcha.
Kevin from InVenture, he's a VC, he's a grower of capital, he's a future professional chef. He's out here investing in Web3. He's a big fan of Another Block Studios. If I have a really good idea, an MVP, a product market fit, where do I go to reach out to you?
Invite me for dinner first. No, just kidding. So you can go LinkedIn. Obviously, it's I think the preferred channel. But other than that, you can slide into my DMs on Twitter or like also just texting me at kevin@inventure.vc. And I think that's the most easy way. And I usually also try to answer every single message, if it's not in 2 or 3 days, at least in a week.
Thank you so much, Kev. I know that this is the second time you've come on, and it's looking good now. So thank you so much.
Of course,
I liked it. That was a great episode.
I liked it too, Isaac. This is the end of the season. And we just wanted to say thank you. We wanted to say thank you to Dave, who is our editor behind the scenes. He'll be watching this right now. He might cut it out, but don't cut it out because we love your work. And we just want to say thanks to Another Block. Thanks to Michelle and Andres, who took a chance. And this is the end of the season. We might be back. We might not. We'll see. We might see you next year. The focus right now is on Twitter Spaces. So if you love what we do and love the conversation, there's more of this. But it's on Twitter Spaces. And so get over there. We're trying to do it every week. And hopefully we'll see you there. Isaac, what do you think?
Yeah, it was a great episode to wrap up the season on. I like to think of it as au revoir rather than goodbye. It's till we meet again. So,
very cultural of you.
It'll be good. I'm at IJSmith01 on Twitter. And
mine will just be somewhere here, hopefully.
Yeah.
I don't even know what mine is.
Notley something. so you can catch us more on Twitter.
Yeah,
you can catch us at our other show, HQLA. There's an episode about Another Block on there, which is really cool.
There you go. That's the first one you should watch with Andreas.
Yeah, so that's episode 23. That one's pretty good. There's also an episode that we mentioned talking about a VC. So we talked about that during this last episode with Kevin.
That episode that you mentioned there, Isaac, with Andreas, that was actually the start of our relationship with Another Block. And so for people who are interested, maybe hardcore fans who are still listening today, really, and this is maybe some inspiration for you guys. We literally just had our own little podcast here where we live in Australia. And Andreas hit us up because we were on, I don't know, I think we did something on TikTok and it kind of went off or something. And he hit us up and he's like, oh, could I come on and you could like interview us about our new project? We're like, oh yeah, we don't really do interviews, but okay, sure. Yeah, right. So we did it. And I think it was maybe the second interview we'd done. And it went pretty good. And he was just literally like, hey, could you like work with us and do what you did, but just do it for us? And so we did. And so we never professed to be, Web3 geniuses, but I think we've made it work. And hopefully some people have found some value. And so, yeah, as Isaac mentioned, we do have a few other things that you can watch if you like us, but stay in touch with Another Block, Twitter Spaces, the website. This is just the start of Another Block, and we'll be along the ride for the journey.
It's been a really fun time making content for Another Block, and we hope that you've enjoyed it as much as we have. We certainly had a few early mornings and a few late nights, but it was all worth it because it was a lot of fun. So, no, big shout out to Andreas and the team at Another Block.
Thank you very much, everybody.